This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Audio Journal. Welcome to Community News, covering the Framingham and Metro West area. Thanks to the Memorial Foundation for the Blind and the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind for their ongoing support. In the next hour, I will be bringing you news from the June 7, 2026 edition of the Metro West Daily News. This is Craig Fife reading to you live from the Patricia A. Fletcher Studio at Audio Journal in Worcester, Massachusetts. And as always, we'll begin with the obituaries from the Sunday edition. Charlene A. Golub, 71, of Ashland, passed away on Thursday, June 4th, at her home after living many years with the symptoms of a rare neurological disorder, HSAN-1E. That stands for Hereditary Sensory and Autonomic Neuropathy Type 1E. Visiting hours will be held on Wednesday, June 10th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Matarese Funeral Home, 325 Main Street, Ashland. The funeral and burial service will be private. In lieu of flowers, donations in Charlene's name may be made to Rails to Trails Conservancy. And you can find their website at railstotrails.org. Alma Piccone McDonald Yeager, a lifelong resident of Framingham, peacefully passed away on Wednesday, May 27th, surrounded by the love of her family. Family and friends are invited to honor and gather and remember Alma's life by gathering for a time of visitation in the McCarthy, McKinney, and Lawler Funeral Home, 11 Lincoln Street, Framingham, on Friday morning, June 12th, from 10 to 11:30 a.m. Her funeral service will be celebrated in the Beacon of Hope United Methodist Church, 360 Water Street, Framingham, at 12 noon. Interment will follow in Edgel Grove Cemetery. For a complete obituary, kindly visit www.mccarthyfh.com. That's MCCARTHYFH. Maureen Evelyn Porcella, 85, of Ashland, passed away on Wednesday, June 3rd, at her home, surrounded by her family. A mass of Christian burial will be celebrated today, Tuesday, June 9th, at 11 a.m. at St. Cecilia's Church, 54 Estee Street, Ashland, with burial to follow in Wildwood Cemetery, Ashland. Visiting hours are being held today from 9 to 10:30 a.m. prior to the funeral mass in the Matarese Funeral Home, 325 Main Street, Ashland. Donations in Maureen's name may be made to the Friends of the Ashland Public Library, 66 Front Street, Ashland, Massachusetts, 01721. Jean C. McGee Ordway of Natick passed away peacefully on June 2nd at the age of 93. Visiting hours in the John Everett and Sons Funeral Home, 4 Park Street, Natick Commons, on Wednesday, June 10th, from 8:30 to 9:30 a.m. This will be followed by a funeral mass at St. Patrick's Church, 44 East Central Street, Route 135, Natick, at 10 a.m. Relatives and friends are kindly invited to attend. Interment following at Dell Park Cemetery, Natick. For directions and guestbook, please visit www.everettfuneral.com. Barbara L. Kaufman, 79, of Ashland, passed away Wednesday, June 3rd. Visiting hours will be held Friday, June 12th, from 2 to 5 p.m. in the Matarese Funeral Home, 325 Main Street, Ashland. Donations in Barbara's memory can be made to the Ashland Ambulance Fund, 73 Cedar Street, Ashland, Massachusetts, or the Ashland Emergency Fund, P.O. Box 112, Ashland, Massachusetts, 01721. Thomas J. Driscoll, Jr., 82, of Framingham, passed away peacefully on May 28th. Family and friends are invited to honor and remember Tom's life by gathering for a time of visitation in the McCarthy, McKinney, and Lawler Funeral Home, 11 Lincoln Street, Framingham, on Tuesday morning, June 16th, that's next week, from 9 to 10:30 a.m. His funeral mass will be held in St. Stephen Church, 221 Concord Street, Framingham, at 11 o'clock. In lieu of flowers, donations may be made in Tom's name to St. Vincent de Paul Society. And you can find their website at https://www.svdpboston.org/donate. To share a memory with the Driscoll family, kindly visit www.mccarthyfh.com. That's MCCARTHYFH.com. And those are the obituaries from the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News. And now continuing with local news. City urged not to renew license plate reader system. This story is by Norman Miller, the Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. The City Police Department has until June 30th to decide whether or not it will renew its contract with Flock Safety, a license plate reader system that many argue works like a type of Big Brother by monitoring people and possibly being used by federal immigration officials. A group of residents calling themselves Framingham Fights Back have started a grassroots effort to convince police officials against renewing the contract. I don't think a lot of people out there in Framingham or other communities realize how much surveillance is really going on out there, said Kate Merritt O'Toole, head of Framingham Fights Back. The police department purchased the cameras in good faith to help with crime and safety, all good reasons. However, Flock is not acting in good faith. Flock opponents say the company collects data from throughout the country and that it's unclear what happens with it or with whom it's shared. While the company says it does not share data with Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement, residents say there's no way to prove it. They, meaning Flock, are on their way to building a mass surveillance tool, Merritt O'Toole said. That's not a conspiracy theory. It's real life. I'll be the first one to say it. When I first started learning about this, I was like, come on, this sounds like a conspiracy theory. This is far-fetched. But it's really not. Several communities throughout the country have dropped Flock, including in Massachusetts. In Natick, the police department joined Flock as part of a pilot program in December. But a month later, the select board ordered the department to leave the program and remove the cameras, citing privacy concerns. Also in December, Cambridge cut ties with Flock after company technicians installed two cameras without the city's knowledge, according to WCVB-TV. Watertown also ended a contract with Flock in January before cameras were even installed. According to the Watertown News, city manager George Proakis said he was concerned about how the data collected would be used by Flock or other agencies. Other local police departments are using the Flock system, including Milford and Marlboro. In March, Medway added several Flock cameras to the two that it had for several years. "We've had them for many years, and they've been managed by us and no one else," Medway Police Chief William Kingsbury told the Daily News in April. "The information we get is purged every 30 days. Flock doesn't sell it. They don't have access to it." A representative for Flock could not be reached for comment. Previously, Flock explained that while it owns the devices, its customers are not allowed to remove or relocate them. Its clients own the data captured by the sensors and can choose whether to share that data and with whom. For its part, Framingham Police have not signed to renew the contract yet, police spokeswoman Lieutenant Rachel Mickens said. She said police are working with the mayor's office and a city council subcommittee regarding the use of cameras and addressing community concerns. Currently, the city solicitor's office is currently reviewing and updating contract language. Based on community feedback, the department has limited information sharing through Flock to only Massachusetts law enforcement agencies. Out-of-state sharing is limited to only criminal cases and is approved on a case-by-case basis. Police also share information on the city's public transparency portal, allowing residents to review information about the program and its use. The Framingham Police Department remains committed to balancing public safety needs with transparency, accountability, and the privacy concerns of the community it serves, Mickens said. Mayor Charlie Sosicki declined to comment. The city's public information officer, Susan Petroni, said the mayor is waiting to see what the city's legal department has to say after reviewing the issue before issuing a statement. The ACLU of Massachusetts has concerns with Framingham's use of Flock. Gideon Epstein, policy counsel for ACLU of Massachusetts, said the organization has done public records requests of Flock's camera data. The ACLU said that when Framingham officers attempted to access Flock data, they are sometimes providing inadequate reasons for doing so. "Just looking at the data, one thing that is immediately concerning is that many of the searches the Framingham police officers do include completely vague and nondescriptive search reasons," Epstein said. "They'll use the word invest, presumably for investigation, or well-being. Some of the searches include just search in the search reason. What's so concerning about the vague description is that it leaves the door open for abuse and misuse." Epstein cited cases from throughout the country, including one in Milwaukee, where an officer used the Flock system more than 100 times to track a romantic partner, as well as one in Texas, where an officer tried to track a woman who left the state to possibly terminate a pregnancy. "Here at ACLU, we actually don't think license plate reading technology inherently creates a problem," Epstein said. "We think it can be a good law enforcement tool. But with proper guardrails, I think, at the core of the problem, Flock is a license plate reader that encourages departments it contracts with to share data." Merritt O'Toole noted that data is stored for 30 days, too long, she thinks. She is also concerned that there's no way to know why another department is using Framingham data. She said, "Even if ICE doesn't have access to the Framingham data, who's to say a department with a good relationship with ICE won't use its access to get information for the federal agency? I don't say this lightly, but I don't think the police departments really appreciate the downstream effect this could have, Merritt O'Toole said. There is definitely a trickle-down effect when data leaves Framingham. We have no idea, and that's the scary part. Framingham Fights Back is asking people to write letters to the department and to the mayor's office expressing their desire for the city to leave the Flock program. The organization has a sample letter at this Google Doc that people can use. Ideally, our end game is to get it shut down, Merritt O'Toole said. We don't want to take a tool out of the Framingham Police Department's hands to hurt their ability to solve crimes. But is it worth the risk of our personal information not being secured? Now, let's take a short break.
Hello. A lot of people are familiar with various assistance programs that provide support for folks with disabilities, money troubles, or food insecurity. But did you know there's one organization which does good work on all three fronts? Welcome to the Department of Transitional Assistance. The DTA serves 1 in 7 residents of the Commonwealth with direct economic assistance like cash benefits and SNAP food assistance, as well as workforce training opportunities. Those served by the department include children, elders, and people with disabilities. And despite the misconceptions you might have heard, many of those who receive benefits from the government work regularly and are gainfully employed. The DTA mission is to assist and empower low-income individuals and families to meet their basic needs, to improve their quality of life, and achieve long-term economic self-sufficiency. The DTA assistance line is open from 8:15 a.m. to 4:45 p.m. That number is 877-382-2363. 877-382-2363.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 17 minutes past the hour. Law seeks to help LaPorta family. This story is by Margie Cullen, USA Today Network, New England. Massachusetts lawmakers are considering a bill that would promote deceased Uxbridge police officer Stephen LaPorta in a move to both honor him and support his family. LaPorta died January 7th in a crash that occurred while he was assisting a motorist on an icy stretch of Route 146. He left behind his wife, Shannon LaPorta, and his young son, Matthew. The bill, filed by Senator Ryan Fatman, Republican Webster, would posthumously promote LaPorta to the rank of sergeant so that his surviving spouse would receive a higher retirement benefit. Fatman, Representative Joe McKenna, and Mass Cop Labor Relations Manager Mike Pereira testified in front of the Joint Committee on Public Service in support of the bill on June 3rd. Day in and day out, they don't know what they're walking into, and they don't know whether they'll make it home from their shift, McKenna said of the police officers, adding that their sacrifice is shared with their family. Sadly for Shannon and Matthew, they did not get to welcome Stephen home from their shift. And it's important for us as a Commonwealth to recognize and honor the family members left behind. The bill would direct the Worcester Regional Retirement System to pay Shannon LaPorta an annual pension amount calculated based on Stephen LaPorta holding the rank of sergeant at the time of his death. Fatman said the town of Uxbridge is 100% in support of the bill, including the Board of Selectmen, the Finance Committee, the town manager, and the whole police department. The legislature has taken similar actions before. Michael Chesna of the Weymouth Police Department was promoted posthumously to sergeant after he was killed in the line of duty in 2018. Fatman asked the committee to expeditiously report the bill out favorably. The legislature has taken other steps to honor LaPorta and other officers killed in the line of duty this year. Both the Senate and House passed a bill to create a new Blue Star family license plate. The plate would be free of charge for Blue Star families or the parent, child, spouse, sibling, or grandchild of a law enforcement officer who was killed in the line of duty. Representative Michael Soter, Republican Bellingham, said on the House floor in May that the bill offers a small yet highly visible token of our enduring gratitude to these survivors. Framingham District Court has acting clerk magistrate. This story is by Norman Miller, Metro West Daily News, USA Today Network. Framingham District Court has a new acting clerk magistrate. Chief Justice of the District Court, Stacy Fortas, has appointed Worcester District Court Assistant Clerk Magistrate Michael Proser as acting clerk magistrate in Framingham District Court. Proser steps in for Clerk Magistrate Robert Jubenville, who has taken a leave of absence after announcing his intention to run for Norfolk County District Attorney. Current Norfolk DA Michael Morrissey announced in January he would not seek re-election. He has held the position since 2011. Proser has been with the Massachusetts trial courts for almost 37 years. Most recently, he has been assistant clerk magistrate in Worcester District Court. He previously served as acting clerk magistrate in Uxbridge District Court. Jubenville has been clerk magistrate in Framingham since 2022. Late 2022, that is. Clerk magistrates hold hearings for criminal complaints, which are often minor crimes that do not involve arrests. The clerk can dismiss the case, move the case before a judge, or issue a fine. In addition, when someone is arrested, a clerk magistrate must find probable cause for charges before the case is arraigned. On occasion, the clerk magistrate can oversee arrangements if a judge is not available and can sign search warrants. Looking for love in Massachusetts? Survey finds four unlikely places. The story is by Ruth Thompson, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. If you're looking for love in Massachusetts, forget smoky bars, sandy beaches, or sweaty gyms. And yes, even, especially, the dating apps. Instead, be sure your antenna is up when you're in the checkout line at Market Basket. Ace.com, an online gaming site, recently reported four seemingly unlikely places to meet your match in the Bay State, based on a national survey that drew 3,024 respondents. Massachusetts results were a subsection of the overall body of work. These spots aren't trying to be romantic, which is part of the appeal, Paul Murphy, general manager of Ace.com, wrote in an email in response to a query from Wicked Local. The survey provided multiple choice options as well as an open-ended option. So, without any further ado, here are four unlikely yet promising romantic spots in Massachusetts. Cape Cod Ferry Terminals. Noted for their excellent waiting for summer to begin energy, ferry terminals are breezy and crowded, allowing for casual chat time and getting to know you moments while waiting in line. Dunkin' Drive-Thru. Exchange a look while waiting for that burst of caffeine, and it could lead to something, perhaps even a complimentary cup of coffee from a driver further up the line. Further places capture the Massachusetts romance essence, like Dunkin' Drive-Thru at 8 a.m. Brimfield Flea Market. Survey respondents say the Brimfield Flea Market is accidental attraction gold. Miles of antiques, odd furniture, vintage signs, mystery objects, and people confidently considering items they absolutely cannot fit in their cars. What can go wrong? It's an environment in which people connect over a weird lamp or a box of old postcards and create a unique chemistry. Market basket checkout line. To some extent, grocery stores have long been considered a promising meeting point, but market basket has an added distinction, survey respondents claim. The 95 store chain's more for your dollar motto allows shoppers to bond over the costs of producing a produce or a good cut of meat. Murphy said everyday places give people an easy reason to talk. No perfect opening line needed when you're both stuck in the same long line or looking at the same weird antique at a flea market, he said. They're everyday Massachusetts settings, which makes a small interaction feel more natural than it would in a formal dating environment. And it's those small interactions that can lead to a serendipitous romance. Survey results found that the rising costs associated with traditional dating may contribute to the appeal of accidental romance. When asked whether rising prices have made conventional date spots, such as bars, restaurants, concerts, or paid activities, seem less appealing, 96% of respondents said yes. Nevertheless, good behavior and manners still matter. Being polite to service workers topped the everyday behaviors list that made a good impression on folks, at least according to 96% of survey respondents. Other everyday behaviors that stood out include helping someone with bags or directions or a photo, returning someone's shopping cart, offering the last seat to someone, being kind to children or dogs, or letting someone cut in line when they're clearly stressed. The biggest accidental romance killer? Being rude to staff at 15%, followed by cutting in line, chronic complaining, being aggressive about parking, littering, and talking loudly on a cell phone. What came through in the survey is that people still like the idea of meeting someone in a more spontaneous way, Murphy said. There's something refreshing about a connection that happens in real life. It feels lower pressure and probably a little more memorable. Pipe dream to legacy. Assabet Valley Master Singers founder to retire. This story is by Ruth Thompson, Wicked Local, USA Today Network. In May 1978, Dr. Robert Eaton brought 28 singers together at Trinity Episcopal Church in Shrewsbury to bring to life a vision he had since his youth. Early on, the ensemble may have worn borrowed robes and put collection baskets at the concert door, but it grew into a regional institution, the Assabet Valley Master Singers. Serving the communities of Shrewsbury, Westboro, Northboro, Southboro, Marlboro, and beyond, AVM, as the chorus is commonly referred as, has brought artistic excellence, community engagement, and visionary programming to all of its performances. Eaton, who continues to serve as artistic director, recently announced he will retire at the end of the 2026-27 concert season. When asked why he is choosing to retire now, Eaton, 79, simply replied, "It's time. It's been 49 years, and the group is in a good place, both musically and organizationally," he said. He has mixed feelings about leaving, of course, but the most important thing is to see the group continue and move forward. "I'll be directing until the end of the 27 season, which will give everyone time to figure things out." Eaton, a native of Vermont, has worked as choral director at Algonquin Regional High School in Northboro and as organist and choir director at the First Congregational Church in Marlboro when he came up with the idea to form the Assabet Valley Master Singers. "I thought it would be great to do more with masterworks and major works," he said. It was something I always wanted to do. It was just a youngster's pipe dream. The Master Singers have presented works by more than 80 composers, mounted an American premiere and a New England premiere, and commissioned 4 original compositions, 3 by Massachusetts composers. Recent seasons have featured 21st century works engaging urgent human concerns, including Malacone's Beatitude Mass for the Homeless, Dan Forrest's Requiem for the Living, Essenwald's The Time Has Come, Gielo's Songs of the Universal, and Vasque's Dona Nobis Pacem. A commitment to the area has always been something of importance to Eaton and the musical group. In 1989, he established the Assabet Valley Chamber Singers, an 18-voiced ensemble dedicated to bringing the larger group's music to nursing homes, library series, gallery openings, and community events throughout the region. The AVM has collaborated with Algonquin Regional High School and the Worcester Children's Chorus and started an apprentice singers program welcoming talented high school vocalists into full membership at no cost. Eaton is able to bring classical music compositions to life with his dedication and passion, said Jennifer Garden, a choral member with Assabet Valley Master Singers and the Chamber Singers. There are times when I can remember thinking that a piece was just too challenging for our volunteer chorus to pull off successfully. And yet, with his perseverance and unwavering faith in us, each performance was outstanding, she said. Garden said her father, Jim, had been a tenor with the group for years, and she had attended many concerts. After graduating high school and witnessing an especially moving performance, I went up to Dr. Eaton to congratulate him on a job well done, and he asked if I would be interested in joining the group, she said. I was so honored that he asked me, and I have been with the group ever since. At one time, both of my brothers, Dan and Dave Garden, sang with the group as well. Judy Yakos, the Master Singers accompanist for 38 years, said, "It's been a deeply rewarding chapter of my life. I usually knew where Dr. Eaton's downbeat was going to land before his baton even moved," she said. "Our collaboration has been the anchor of the choir, and I can honestly say I've had the honor and privilege of working with the very best." Eaton retired as choral director at Algonquin Regional High School in 2005 after 32 years, and as minister of music at the First Baptist Church in Lexington after 15 years in 2020. He said he has a year to figure out what he will do with all his free time after retiring from the Master Singers. "It has been the honor of my life to stand before this chorus," he said. "We have built something extraordinary together, a community of musicians committed to the belief that great choral music enriches every life it touches. I am immensely proud of what the Assabet Valley Master Singers has become, and I am confident in the bright future that lies ahead. I wish the world could experience the community of AVM." And now let's take a short break.
Would you like to hear news from Auburn, Grafton, Millbury, and Sutton that you're not likely to hear on commercial television or radio? Then tune in to Audio Journal every Monday at 5 p.m.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 34 minutes past the hour. No Fame Games are again coming to Milford. This story is by Beth McDermott, Milford Daily News, USA Today Network. The 6th annual No Fame Games, a celebration of Celtic culture and athletics, is set for Saturday, June 13th in Milford. The event, modeled after the Scottish Highland Games, will take place from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Pheno Field Complex Annex, according to a community announcement. Athletes from around the world will participate in 5 competitions and 2 championships. Championships include the North American Scottish Backhold Wrestling Championships and the Northeast Irish Collar and Elbow Championships, the latter returning to New England after a 100-year hiatus, according to the announcement. The games will also feature traditional Celtic strength sports, including the Scottish Highland Games heavy events, Team Highlander competition, CrossFit Highlander Challenge, and the Stones of Strength Challenge. There will also be demonstrations of Butteracht, Irish stick fighting. The No Fame Games aims to foster and promote Celtic strength, culture, and traditional athletics, according to the announcement. We believe true strength is bringing people together, so we all positively impact the sport, culture, and community by using active and creative ways of staying healthy, said No Fame Games founder Joshua McIntosh in a statement. Heritage, community, and growth are our pillars. The event is expected to have a festive atmosphere with live music and youth athletics, including a tug-of-war against the pros, according to the announcement. There will be Celtic vendors offering gourmet food and the Black Harp Traveling Irish Pub. No Fame Games was founded in 2021 as a community-focused corporation to promote Celtic strength culture and traditional athletics worldwide. Those interested in attending can purchase tickets at sitickets.com/NoFameGames. For more information, visit NoFameGames.com. Mike's Pastry headed to Boston's Logan Airport. This story is by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. Travelers at Boston's Logan International Airport will soon be able to taste a North End classic even before leaving the terminal. Mike's Pastry, the iconic Italian bakery known for its cannoli, plans to open a food stall inside Terminal C this year, according to the airport's retail developer, Marketplace Development. The outpost will feature the bakery's filled-to-order cannoli, cheesecake slices, lobster tails, and a full espresso bar, giving flyers another way to fuel up before or after a flight. It will also offer travel-ready items for passengers to bring on board a plane and to take to family and friends, the developer said. Mike's Pastry has always been about sharing a piece of Boston with everyone who walks through our doors, owner Angelo Papa said in a statement. Bringing that experience to Boston Logan is special for us. Whether you're headed out or just arriving, we're excited to give travelers an easy way to grab a true taste of the North End. Excuse me. Beyond its flagship North End location, Mike's Pastry also operates shops in Cambridge's Harvard Square, Somerville's Assembly Row, and Boston's TD Garden. Near each location, customers can be seen toting the bakery's signature white and blue boxes tied with string. Mike's Pastry's Logan Airport stall is slated to be open 7 days a week from 5 a.m. to 10 p.m. While Mike's Pastry is expected to open at Logan sometime in 2026, an exact date has not been announced. Mike's Pastry, founded in 1946, currently has 4 Boston-area locations, including its original North End store. Boston, North End, 300 Hanover Street. Boston, TD Garden, 100 Legends Way. Cambridge, 11 Dunster Street, and Somerville, 445 Revolution Drive. Clover comeback begins at key Boston area locations. This story is by Bailey Allen, USA Today Network, New England. Clover, the Boston area vegetarian fast food chain that announced its closure last week, is coming back. The restaurant, founded by MIT graduate Ayer Muir in 2008, said it had been struggling financially, especially following the COVID-19 pandemic. Clover's 11 Massachusetts locations and catering business shuttered on May 28th. Excuse me. Less than a week later, on June 3rd, a Clover spokesperson said an investor had stepped in and that the company would reopen its doors this month. We finalized a deal with a mission-aligned investor who was motivated by the strength of the brand and the differentiation of our locally sourced menu, the spokesperson said in an email to USA Today Network. CEO Julia Prin Piper said the outpouring of support from customers helped pave the way for Clover's return. Last Tuesday, when we announced we were closing after 17 years, we were not prepared for the response. We knew people would miss us, but we didn't understand how much they would miss us, Piper said in a statement on Clover's website. At a certain point, the amount of public outcry became so widespread that it led to an email, then a phone call, then several phone calls, and then some very late-night meetings. The chain built a following for its plant-based, kosher-certified menu items, including sandwiches, rice bowls, salads, soups, cookies, and teas. Clover did not provide details about its new investor, but added that it would be making some changes to address its financial challenges. Inflationary pressures on our industry remain an issue, of course, and we are now working hard on implementing operational changes to ensure the financial stability of Clover, the spokesperson said. Clover is set to reopen its core Cambridge and Somerville locations at lunchtime on Tuesday, June 9th, that's today, according to Piper. The chain will begin serving breakfast again on Wednesday, June 10th. It was not immediately clear whether Clover will reopen its other locations outside of Cambridge and Somerville. The company said it will continue updating customers as it works to reopen. If you love Clover, when we reopen, could you commit to introducing one new person to us? Every one of you reading this is an ambassador for our mission, Piper said. Tell a coworker, trick a skeptical carnivore, bring your crush. More customers flocking to Costco gas stations. This story is by Nicholas P. Brown and Juvaria Tabasum, Reuters. Costco wholesale reaped the spoils of surging gas prices as more consumers sought out its lower-priced fuel, helping it top market expectations for third-quarter sales. The final 5 weeks of the quarter were Costco's highest ever in terms of sales volume, CEO Ron Vecris said on an earnings conference call May 28th. Gas prices exceeding $4 a gallon, on the rise as the war with Iran drags on, drove many Costco members to use its gas stations for the first time, Vecris said. The company took advantage, lowering gas prices to drive volume. We've widened our gaps in terms of price, Chief Financial Officer Gary Miller-Chip said on the call. we know that's something that's high on our members' minds. The uptick in Phillips could boost Costco's bottom line, as members who use its gas stations typically spend more in the warehouses, Vekras said. Costco said it has maintained lower prices on beef, which, along with higher transportation costs, affected its margin in the third quarter. Prices, however, stayed higher for appliances due to the elevated cost of memory chips, Miller Chip said. If oil prices stay high, items with plastic or apparel made of polyester or cotton could remain more expensive, he said. That investment in everyday low price positioning during a period of macroeconomic uncertainty is classic Costco, said Brian Hayes, stock strategist at Zacks Investment Research. But, he said, it does suggest that the gross margin line could face modest near-term pressure as the company prioritizes member loyalty over rate. Including gas, U.S. comparable sales jumped 9.4% during the quarter, beating analysts' estimate of a near 7% rise, according to data compiled by LSEG. Costco's shares have gained about 15% so far this year, compared with an 8% rise in the S&P 500 Consumer Staples Index. They were unchanged in indexed trading. Costco is also investing in fast delivery at a time when giants such as Walmart and Amazon are whittling down shipping times in a quest for e-commerce dominance. Costco's average same-day delivery time in the U.S. is now less than 45 minutes, Vekras said. Refunds from outlawed tariffs, meanwhile, were expected to begin flowing in the next 2 to 3 months, the company said. Vekras reiterated that tariff refunds would pass on to consumers in some form, depending on the amount of return and developments in the March class action suit filed against Costco, by customers seeking a share of refunds. Total quarterly revenue rose 12% to $70.3 billion, beating analyst estimates of $69.81 billion. Its net income jumped 15% to $2.19 billion, while adjusted earnings per share of $4.93 met expectations. And now let's pause for a short break.
What's your vision?
My vision's 20/200.
Light perception in the right eye and zero vision in the left eye.
20/200 at best on my left eye, and on my right eye, I cannot see.
No, I mean, what's your vision?
My goal is to become a journalist.
To be able to work.
Financial independence.
My vision is employment opportunities for all, including people with disabilities.
My vision is for all of my students to dream big.
That he become fully independent.
For my patients to live their best lives.
What's your vision?
What's your vision?
What is your vision?
At the Massachusetts Commission for the Blind, our vision is clear. We believe that all people who are blind or visually impaired should have the opportunity to work and thrive. To learn how we can help you meet your employment or workforce goals, call 800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/mcb.
You're listening to the Sunday edition of the Metro West Daily News, where the time now is approximately 49 minutes past the hour. Leo urges leaders to stop dividing. Pope meets migrants and youth in Spain visit. This story is by Joshua McElwee and Charlie Devereux, Reuters. Pope Leo XIV on June 6th urged global leaders to stop dividing their electorates with sterile simplifications, calling on them to listen to the world's cries for peace as he met migrants, and some 600,000 young people at the start of a week-long tour of Spain. Leo, who has angered President Donald Trump by criticizing his anti-immigration policies and the Iran war, visited a church-run shelter for the homeless in Madrid and will meet migrants in the Canary Islands during the five-stop visit. He said before touching down in Spain that he hoped the tour would set an example to the world about respecting every human being. Today, the temptation to gain popularity by fanning the flames of polarization seems to have grown rather than diminished, and human dignity continues to be violated, Leo said in a speech before King Philippe VI at the Royal Palace in Madrid. I invite everyone to set aside the diverse and polarizing narratives of your societal reality and history so as to overcome sterile simplifications through the fruitful appreciation of complexity, he added. Technology was partly to blame for creating an environment that magnifies prejudices and weakens critical thinking, Leo said. He drew on Spain's history as an example of peaceful cohabitation between religions and cultures, making reference to how Christians, Muslims, Jews cooperated during medieval times to enhance human knowledge by translating Arab texts into Latin, Spanish, and Hebrew at the School of Translators in Toledo. Your own history suggests that a culture of encounter, not confrontation, is what fosters stability and prosperity, he said. Hundreds of thousands lined the streets of central Madrid to witness the first visit to Spain by a pope since 2011. Some waved Vatican and Spanish flags or held up babies to be blessed as Leo toured in an open-air popemobile from which he was seen again doing the 6-7 hand gesture, popular among young people. A 2025 survey by Fundación SM found that there has been a surge in interest in Catholicism by young people in Spain, with 28.8% declaring themselves practicing Catholics in 2025, compared to 17.6% in 2020. When I see the Pope doing the 6-7, it feels familiar. I think there will be more and more Catholics because of him, said Perla Garcia, 15, as she waited for Leo to attend a vigil. In the afternoon, Leo visited a homeless shelter where he heard stories of migrants who had been helped to settle when they first arrived in Madrid. In sharp contrast to many leading Western powers, not least Trump's United States, Socialist Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez's government has opened a mass amnesty program, allowing an estimated 500,000 immigrants to apply for legal status. Senegalese migrant Kadri, who gave the Pope a replica of his Spanish residency card, described feeling lost and alone when he first arrived in Spain. I had left everything behind and didn't know where to start. Today I have a job, I've sorted out my immigration status, and I want to support others who arrive here, just as I did. The Pope's visit to the Spanish capital coincided with concerts by Puerto Rican singer Bad Bunny, and local church officials have indicated a meeting between the two is possible while the Pope is in Madrid. During his June 6th through 12th trip, Leo will also inaugurate a new tower in Barcelona's famed Sagrada Familia Basilica and will meet survivors of sexual abuse by Catholic clergy, the Vatican said, adding that further details will be provided after the meeting. Trump faces GOP resistance in Congress. More break ranks as midterm elections loom. This story is by David Morgan, Reuters. President Donald Trump is facing widening opposition within his own party as Republican lawmakers in Congress, long reluctant to defy him, are showing a greater willingness to break ranks. Just over the past week, multiple factions of Republicans in the Senate and House have stepped forward to rebuke his war against Iran, reject $1 billion in funding tied to his White House ballroom, force a retreat on his $1.8 billion anti-weaponization fund, and block his legislation on domestic spying. The House also defied Trump by passing a bill on June 4th to provide aid to Ukraine and impose new sanctions on Russia, a measure that seems destined to for a veto by the president. Republicans and Democrats are skeptical that Trump faces an actual revolt, but a growing coalition of Republicans is showing a willingness to break with him, including those Trump has personally helped to drum out of office and could pose a threat to his most ambitious initiatives between now and Election Day. I think you're seeing, as you get closer to the election, that the people are going to vote the way they think their constituents want them to. Senate Republican Tom Tillis of North Carolina, who announced his retirement from the Senate last year after opposing the president's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. And this is all the time we have for our broadcast. You have been listening to a reading of the Metro West Daily News for Sunday, June 7th, 2026. This community news program is a production of Audio Journal, a proud member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. If you would like a hard copy of our program schedule, either in large print or braille, please call 508-797-1117. Archived editions of this program are available on our website, audiojournal.org, or go to the Audio Journal app on your iPhone, iPad, or Android device. I'm Craig Fife, and I thank you for listening.
There are more than 1 million English words. Next up, word nerd Steph Donoff with some of them worth talking about.
The Latin alphabet was first developed more than 2,000 years ago in Italy and had only 23 letters to start with, not 26, 23. The J, the U, and the W started to show up once printing was developed in the 1600s. They were not formally added to the alphabet, they were absorbed slowly over time. In 1611, the first edition of the King James Bible spelled James with an I, pronounced as a J, as was Joseph, John, and even Jesus. But some unknown scribe had created the letter J, and it was used in the 1629 edition, and since it was good enough for the Bible, everyone started using it. Now, before printing, the letter V also did double duty. As a consonant, it was written as a pointy bottom V, pronounced V. When used as a vowel, the V was given a round bottom and pronounced as U, but it was still treated as a V. As printing developed, it was printed as two separate letters and the letter U was born. Now, the W started as two V's stuck together, even though it meant the sound of two U's stuck together. By the way, there are a few English words with double U's, but only three of them are in common use. Vacuum, continuum, and to dress it up a bit, Hawaiian moo-moos.
That's enough talk about words. Let's go back to listening to them.
What's going on in your town is important to you. Meetings that decide your taxes, changes in laws in your community, plans for new housing and businesses, and news about schools are all vital for you to know. Here on Audio Journal, we read many local community newspapers each week. In addition to the news of your community and area, you'll also hear about special events, stories about your neighbors, their businesses, their activities, and more. Stay in touch with your community on Audio Journal, broadcasting to print-impaired residents of Central Massachusetts.